Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, where she is a clinical instructor. You know, I was in Saskatchewan last week, kind of a golf vacation. And in the vacation area where I was at, in Waskasoo, a park there, I saw many folks on vacation with their dogs, walking their dogs, and even one walking their cat.
Well, this is the time of the year when people are traveling, and one of the things that you really need to look into are, you know, what are the regulations of where you're going? Can you have your dog off leash? Do you need health certificates to potentially get from one country to another if you're traveling just from the United States to Canada? And what do you need? And in fact, in getting into Canada, it's pretty simple. You just need a rabies certificate to get back and forth, a valid rabies certificate. You don't need a health certificate, although it's always helpful to have that extra document in case something happens. But, you know, for people that are going to be traveling and they're concerned about different diseases, which we should be when we're traveling, to make sure that your pet is up to date and on the preventatives that they should be, the Companion Animal Parasite Council, which is got one of my favorite websites. It's called capcvet.org.
Cap, is it?
At Cap, C-A-P-C. Companion Animal Parasite Council, vet.org. I am on that site probably every day, but then I'm a parasite nerd. So, you know, I'm always looking up things. But one of the things that they've started to produce is another website that's updated every month. And they've been doing this now for about 7 or 8 years. So we've got some pretty good tracking information. And it's called PetDisease.org, all one word. And what it does is it has 30-day forecasts for different tick-borne and mosquito-borne diseases that affect dogs. They really have only focused in on dogs at this point. So they're looking at Lyme, Ehrlichia, Anaplasma, heartworm, and it's not only based on the country, but every state is down to the county level as well. So perhaps, you know, one of our listeners is deciding, well, I'm going to travel, you know, up north to a county up north. What is the incidence of Lyme disease up there? Well, our state in general is in the high alert red zone, but then even broken down within the county level, there are some counties that have it more of an issue than we have and down in this area. So it can be quite variable, but it's just nice to know that you better have your pet on some prevention if you're going to be traveling in areas like that. So it's a really nice thing for I find professionally to look at, to just see how different tick-borne diseases have spread over the years, and they definitely are increasing. And so using that before you hit the road, I think, is really helpful. And just remember, it's so safe to have your pet on year-round flea and tick and heartworm prevention, and that pretty much covers where you're going to be traveling, just about anywhere in the country.
You don't want to avoid areas. If you want to go someplace, you want to go.
But if it's a heavy area and you're perhaps using a flea and tick preventative that you maybe don't trust as much, you may want to make sure that when you get back from your outing, you spend some time looking for ticks on your pet, actually spreading the toes apart and having a look and looking behind the ears. I had one owner that actually said they use a hairdryer on just with cool air because the dog had longish hair and it just helped to blow and part the hair, and they're very able to quickly go over the whole dog's body to see if there are any ticks visiting or not, so they can get them off before they start feeding and transmitting disease.
That's a great idea.
I know. I thought it was a very good idea.
Well, Connie in Portage has something for us, so let's go to Connie. Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a he's almost 8-year-old corgi, and he's a diabetic. He gets insulin twice a day, but he does not like to travel, and we like to go to Florida in our motorhome, and he runs continuously back and forth, panting. He doesn't want to eat. He doesn't want to sleep, and he keeps tilting his head down looking at the motor, and if there's a truck goes by when we're home, he's scared of motors.
Oh, this is...
We don't want to hurt him, so what do we do?
Yeah, this is really tough because a dog that has diabetes is a real intense patient care pet to be able to own, and you need to make sure that they're getting the, you know, the food at a regular time and that the same amount of exercise, and obviously this trip is very stressful for them. I would be talking to your veterinarian about using some type of temporary anti-anxiety medication that may make traveling a little bit easier for your dog. And there's all kinds of you know, levels that you can go from some of the over-the-counter products. Like there's one called Composure that VetraScience makes. There's another one called Soliquin. They're all natural supplements that are really, some of them are very effective for mild anxieties. And it sounds like your dog has some pretty severe anxieties when they're traveling. You may want to be looking at getting one of the benzodiazepines for your dog that you can just use when you're going down to Florida, because they start working right away, and then you can taper them off of it after you're there for a day or two. And that would be drugs in the Valium, Xanax type family, and they can be very effective and would be compatible with a dog that is a diabetic. So I don't think there's too many psychoactive drugs that wouldn't be, but that would be something that we'd always be concerned about. And making sure that you do have a veterinarian down there that you are working with in case your dog does have any complications with its diabetes, have that lined up ahead of time. Maybe have a copy of your medical records available so that, you know, the vet down there knows the type of insulin you're using and syringe size and your dog's last glucose curve. All that information would make patient transfer a lot easier.
That's
down the road.
Very good advice. Yeah. Very good advice. Good luck, Connie. Thank you so much for calling. Danielle in Allenton, it's your turn. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So my cat likes to run around outside, and we live in kind of a wooded area, and he had a tick on him probably about a month and a half ago. Well, I pulled it off, and then 3 weeks later, he became very, very lethargic, and he stopped eating, he stopped drinking. I took him into the vet, but we have limited resources, so I wasn't able to get any blood work done on him. I think it was Lyme's disease, but I'm not exactly sure, and I was just wondering how long it might take for the symptoms, all the symptoms, to subside.
Yeah, Lyme disease is very uncommon in cats. They tend to be quite resistant to it. And so whenever I have a cat that's been exposed to a tick but develops an illness, it wouldn't be the first thing on my radar. I'd be worried about things like, did your cat get bit by another cat and is incubating an abscess? Have they picked up one of the other contagious diseases that can happen when they may be exposed to other stray cats, like feline leukemia or FIV? You know, those types of things would be things that I'd be looking into. So doing a, you know, head-to-toe physical exam, you know, unfortunately, most of the testing requires getting some blood work done. If your cat does have Lyme disease, they typically present like you're describing, really lethargic, painful joints, maybe can progress to other symptoms. There's a rare condition that we see in dogs that's called Lyme nephritis that has been reported in cats as well. But one of the things that you could potentially do is talk to your veterinarian and say, well, you know, if it is this disease, I don't have the funds to treat it. Can we go ahead diagnose it? Can we go ahead and treat it? And treatment is using a drug called doxycycline. It's a synthetic tetracycline. The problem with cats is they have such dry mucous membranes in their mouth and their esophagus that the medication that we can usually get down dogs really safely can cause esophagitis or esophageal irritation in cats. So whenever you give that medication, you always have to follow it up with a water chaser. So you can imagine, not only are you having to pill or give your cat a liquid medication, but also follow it up with some water, which they don't tend to like. So it's not something you want to just jump in and do. But if your cat is having persistent symptoms, that might be something to consider that would not be at this point that expensive. Doxycycline was really expensive a few years ago. Now the price has dropped, so it might be something that would be within your budget to be able to at least try something for your cat.
There you go. Good luck, Danielle. Thank you so much for calling. Chris in Adams, it's your turn. Hi, Chris.
Happy March still. I was traveling up to Massachusetts, only human in the car with three large dogs, and I'm tooling down the New York Turnpike at 75 miles an hour, and one of the dogs opened the side door on my van. Not a fun situation. I managed to not kill anybody, and we ended up okay, but I just want to remind people that they do have doggy harnesses. You should buckle your animals down in the back of your vehicle for their safety and yours, and that's a really important thing about traveling. I mean, I was in a situation where I couldn't get off the road. Where everybody's going by me at 90 miles an hour.
Wow.
And it was very, very dangerous. And, I couldn't stop because I would have ended up with three dogs out on the highway. So,
yeah, this is just one of those like horror stories that you hear about. And boy, I'm going to be traveling with my three dogs next month as well. And, you know, we always make sure that we have not only their microchip information that is readable with a microchip scanner and up to date, but that they all wear external ID with my cell phone number on it so that in case we do get separated, you know, God forbid there's an accident or anything like that, at least then they would be able to, you know, locate the dog if they do get, do escape. So, oh my goodness. Yes. I cannot believe that you went through all of that, but I'm glad everybody was safe. It is an art to being able to travel safely with pets, you know, having a pet first aid kit, traveling with their food, vet clinics in the future that you can potentially stop at if you have to, if you're in a location, having access to your medical records if necessary, especially if your dog has a chronic disease, like the person that called with the dog with diabetes. Those are all really important things to be considering. So not just as simple as throwing the dogs in the car. You got to pack for them as well.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. Todd in Janesville, thank you for calling.
Hi, Sandy. Todd. We just want to, for people traveling with their pets, we travel our dog when we go in a motorhome, but we were at a campground and some people brought their Yorkie up and there's no dogs allowed in the cabin. They brought a little tent up for the dog and the dog woke everybody up at the campground every morning at 5 a.m. It was scared to death. And
have
the dog in the cabin or it'd be $50 charge. I'm like, I'll pay you the $50. Just keep the dog in the cabin with you.
Yeah.
So, and then we went for a nice little rest, a real nice dinner on deck and the same people brought their dog and it barked in the car entire dinner. So some dogs need to be left to homeless family or friends. And
right.
If you are traveling with in a motorhome, if you have thermostat-controlled fans on your motorhome, just so the motorhome will overheat just like a car.
Right, right. And, you know, and that's just it. Know your pet. Some of them would be very happy to just stay at home with either a pet sitter or going to a boarding facility rather than traveling. Fortunately, my dogs love to travel, and it's hard to get them out of our RV once we get them in. They just think that that's like their second home. But again, those are all really good tips that knowing that if you have to be leaving your dog alone, do you have a generator that is working well? Or do you have some type of device on your phone that can send you remote info regarding what the temperature is inside the vehicle so that if something happens, power goes out, generator goes out, you could be there to rescue your pets, especially in, you know, with hot summer weather. And, you know, some dogs just, they don't do well alone. And barking is one of those things that even though I'm a veterinarian and I love dogs, boy, having a dog that's being a nuisance to everyone just ruins everybody's vacation.
Absolutely. Thank you for calling, Todd. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer, Breanne Chasso, our on-air producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Mike in Minocqua next. Mike, hi.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Good show.
Thank you.
We're, we're traveling out to the Outer Banks of North Carolina with our Schnauzer, and he likes to go in the water sometimes. I was just wondering what about salt water, and is salt water of any problem for dogs and their skin? I mean, do you have to really wash it off well, or?
Yeah, I'd be really concerned if your dog wants to drink from the ocean. That would be the problem. If you've ever got salt water in your mouth, it can be very nauseating. And if they're drinking it, it can be quite dehydrating, and you can end up with what's called salt toxicity. So making sure that you have plenty of fresh water around so that the dog is drinking that and not drinking from the ocean. Be really careful that you know that you're on beaches that allow dogs. Many beaches that are open to the public do not allow dogs because primarily it's the risk of parasites that dogs may harbor in their fecal material that can be transmitted to people. Things like hookworms, which if the eggs turn into larvae, can penetrate through our skin and cause something called cutaneous larval migraines. So there are health risks to people in areas where dogs go. So be really careful when you're doing that. And yeah, they probably are going to get a little crusty, just like, you know, our skin gets that kind of salt covering, and would feel a lot more comfortable being bathed after being in the salt water. Probably best to just avoid taking your dog there. I always worry, too, about the sand. Dogs that aren't used to sand and are walking across it, it can be quite abrasive to their feet. You may want to look into, if you are going to be taking your dog to the beach, something called paws, P-A-W-Z. They're little balloons that can go like booties that can go on your dog's feet. They stay on. They're fairly waterproof, and it can prevent the sand and things from getting in between the pads and causing irritation.
All right. There you go, Mike. Good luck. Have fun on the Outer Banks. It's a wonderful place to visit. Mm-hmm. Been there. Kay in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about anaplasmosis. I have my dog right now on an antibiotic for that, and I'm just wondering how long it might take for him to recover, and will he totally recover?
What symptoms did he have?
He has been real lethargic, and he's having trouble. He's a terrier mix, and it used to be if I would walk towards the bedroom, he would run ahead of me and jump on the bed. He hasn't been on the bed for weeks. He hasn't been wanted to jump into his chair he likes to sit in.
Mm-hmm.
And he's even having trouble walking up the back steps.
Okay. Yeah, anaplasmosis is a tick-borne disease that often goes hand in hand with Lyme disease. We see it at about the same level as we do Lyme disease in the state. It's spread by the same tick, the deer tick. And the symptoms that it typically causes are very similar to Lyme disease in that it can cause fever and lethargy, lameness. But the thing that's unique about it is it does have an effect on the bone marrow. And we can sometimes see some cell count changes, primarily platelet count changes are one of the things that we can see. And the platelets are involved with the clotting mechanism. So whenever we have a dog that is test positive for anaplasma, if they're totally asymptomatic, not showing any sign of lameness or fever, having any troubles, we still do a blood cell count to make sure that we don't have some subclinical disease that we need to be made aware of and start paying attention to. The treatment for this disease is usually we treat for a month with a tetracycline-like drug, something called doxycycline, a synthetic tetracycline. And the majority of dogs will fairly quickly, usually within a few days of being started on the medication, start getting back to their old self again. We do see a number of dogs that test anaplasma positive but are not affected by the disease. And that's the problem with the test, is that it just indicates exposure, does not indicate that your dog is actually sick. And so it really comes down to ruling out other things that could make your dog lethargic and having other problems. So it may mean getting complete chemistry blood work done, getting a head-to-toe physical done again if your veterinarian hasn't already done that, perhaps getting urine samples checked, going down the path of just that investigating everything to try to figure out what's going on. To give you an example, I had a dog in that was testing positive for one of these tick-borne diseases but ended up having an autoimmune problem affecting its joints. absolutely unrelated to the tick-borne disease and needed to be treated with a different drug for a much different period of time. And the antibiotic that's used to treat the tick-borne disease would not have helped this dog. So if your dog isn't getting better and is being treated appropriately for a tick-borne disease, time to go back and start investigating all those other causes.
Good luck, Kay. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mary Lou in Monroe, it's your turn.
Hello. I have got three cats, Mama Cat and two of her kittens. The kittens are about 5 years old now. And the little boy cat, I love him a lot. He's a real character. However, he has taken to starting to spray on my furniture.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, and he was neutered when he was a kitten.
Yeah. Now, when you say spraying, he's actually backing up and passing urine vertically on your furniture, so his tail's quivering, prancing with his back feet and shooting out a stream of urine.
I finally caught him last week doing it.
Okay, and that's what he's doing. Okay, because we have to differentiate between squatting and just inappropriate elimination and urine marking or spraying, because they can be different, totally different things. We know that neutered male cats, 1 in 10 will urine mark at some point in their life. So it doesn't, you know, just having him neutered is going to decrease it phenomenally, but you still have that issue of 1 in 10 will still urine mark at some point. What causes them to urine mark is usually social stress with other cats in the environment. And it may not be the cats that are in the house, but I'd be really carefully looking at the social interactions between those cats to see if there is any stressors that are affecting them, and making sure that you've got plenty of resources with three cats, at least 4 litter boxes in 4 different locations in your home, multiple feeding stations, cat trees, resting areas, again, so that they're not feeling cramped in their space. But also be looking at outdoors. This is the time of the year that we start opening our windows, and there are stray cats many times that are nocturnal that may be coming around, and that can be enough to be driving your cat a little crazy and having them urine mark. The way I describe this, actually, I just described this to a friend. You know, when you look at graffiti, you rarely ever see humans doing graffiti out in the country where it's less crowded. Where do you see graffiti? Usually in areas where people are marking their turf. And cats just can't work a spray paint can, so they use their next best thing, their urine. And so, you know, when we're dealing with this, it's important to not only address the environment, and it may mean keeping windows closed, keeping air conditioners on, blocking visual cues outside by putting contact paper or something on windows that he may be looking out of, trapping strays that may be outside, and then making sure you're also cleaning the affected areas appropriately. One of my favorite urine smell eliminators is called AIP. It stands for anti-icky poo. You can get it with a syringe that you can inject into your furniture, because the urine is actually soaked into the padding and things. So you need to get it down in there. You just can't treat it superficially. And that hopefully will get things under control. But this would be something that, again, talking to your veterinarian, if it becomes an issue that you are not getting under control, doing all the things that we talked about, we sometimes have to resort to medical management with psychoactive drugs to make the cat feel calmer so that it can live in the environment and be less stressed.
And there you go, Mary Lou. Thank you so much for calling. Take some more calls. Rick in Sparta has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
My question is, there's about 8,000 over-the-counter tick remedies or preventatives for cats. I've used them all. The cats get ticks. I'm kind of at a loss.
Yeah, the big concern that we have is that there really are not that many safe over-the-counter tick products for cats. That, you know, when you're saying there's a multitude of them out there, I could probably count on one, maybe one hand and an extra finger, the number of products that would be effective. Some of my favorite products are the Seresto collar that the Bayer company makes that is available over the counter, lasts for 8 months, and it is a very safe collar. It is a breakaway, so they can lose it if they're outside, but it is very different than other tick collars and flea collars that may be out there. And it's, again, very effective for 8 months. The other products would be spot-on products. There's like things like Frontline that is available for cats that you would put on once a month. There's a prescription product now that's called Revolution Plus that not only gets fleas and ticks, but it also gets heartworm, intestinal parasites, and ear mites as well.
Wow.
So it's a lot more broad spectrum to help cover all of that. And then you start getting into, you know, there are lots of just flea products, but trying to find something that's going to get fleas and ticks, you're really limited. And those would be probably the ones that I would be looking into. Revolution Plus, Frontline, or the Seresto Collar.
There you go, Rick. Good luck. Thank you so much. And AJ and Mazamani, your turn. Hi.
Hello. How are you folks?
Great.
I've got a Malamute, Samara, about 9 years old. She's been on prednisone for low platelet count for about 6 years. Also a thyroid issue. And wondering how detrimental that prednisone is to her with this being given to her for so long.
Yeah, so I assume she was diagnosed with a condition called immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, or the immune system was starting to fight the platelets so that she wasn't able to clot. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. The majority of dogs that have that as a condition, once we treat them and they go into remission, we're often able to very slowly taper them down and get them off of the prednisolone or prednisone. Has your veterinarian been following this and been trying to taper her down?
We're following it. I get blood tests every 2 months, 3 months.
Okay.
But I have not been tapering it down, and that's my concern.
Yeah. If her platelet counts have been staying normal, then I'd be talking to your veterinarian about very slowly. Again, when we say slowly, we're talking about over several months, gradually tapering down with rechecking platelet counts after the dose has been dropped to make sure that we're not having it get down low again. Most dogs can get off of prednisone. There are some that need to stay on some type of an immunosuppressive drug to be able to keep their platelet counts up. But I would be looking at talking to your veterinarian about, can we get her off of this? Because long-term prednisone is going to thin the skin, suppress the immune system. Obviously, that's how it's working to keep the platelet count up to snuff. And it can start affecting the liver and adrenal glands. So we'd like to try to get her off of it. But low platelet count can be a life-threatening problem for the dog. So you've got to go about it really under veterinary supervision to make sure that we're not going too quickly.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had Will emailed us. He's a rabbit enthusiast involved with rabbit associations that have to battle domestic rabbits being abandoned, which is too bad. He wonders if you have any advice about deterring people from dumping their rabbits.
Yeah, this is a big problem because people look at pet rabbits and they see the wild rabbits outside and think, well, I got this rabbit for Easter. I don't want it anymore. We can just set it out. And they are no more adept at surviving in the wild than your grandmother's chihuahua. You know, they were domesticated to be pets and kept indoors and with, you know, in a safe environment. So my best advice is before you adopt a bunny, do your homework to know what you're getting into, because these are pets that can be with you for many years. They do need to be spayed and neutered. They have specific dietary needs, housing needs. Many of them do well but it can be litter box trained and can do well outside of being in a pen, and can live in your house quite happily, often with other species. But it does take doing your homework to know that you are getting a pet that you're prepared for. So I think that's the number one thing, is avoid the fact that it's unwanted. If you can't keep a rabbit, we do have locally the Pet Rabbit, House Rabbit Association. I'd be contacting local humane societies. They often take rabbits in, and many times these rabbits can be rehomed successfully into other homes.
Marty emailed to ask if there's a product you recommend to minimize barking, like a bark collar or CBD for dogs. How can you train a dog to stop barking when a motorcycle or a kid goes by?
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, you know, this is an issue where you know what the trigger is, that it's a motorcycle or a child going by. I would be making sure that the dog is not outside unattended, and that when they are outside, you've got under your belt a phenomenal recall where you can get the dog to turn and look at you and sit. It's very hard to get a good bark in when your fanny's on the ground. And you may even have to set up situations where you have your dog on a leash out in your backyard or wherever you happen to have your dog. Your pocket full of treats, you have your dog, it's hungry, maybe you didn't give him breakfast that morning, and you have one of your neighborhood kids across like a distance away, and say, just start walking very slowly, a little closer, while you have your dog sitting, getting treats, and this is a really good experience for the dog. It's going to be a little harder with motorcycles because, you can't stop traffic in your neighborhood, but you can control the environment that your dog is in. And that's one of my pet phrases: if you can't control the dog, control the environment, which means keep your dog in the house. And when they're outside, you're working on them, and there to be able to bring them in away from a situation like that. When it comes to collars, there are bark collars. My one that seems to be effective and ethically correct is one that's called the Citronella bark collar. It works probably a good 80% of the time, where when the dog is barking, the vibration of the bark triggers a Citronella spray to go past the dog. They hear it, see it, and smell it, and will often give you that very millisecond of them stopping and going, what was that? So that you can then turn the dog away from the stimulus, have them sit and be quiet and get something from you. So it's often a training tool. It's not going to train your dog totally. You have to be there.
Let's take another call. Andrea in Racine, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, this is a little bit of a complicated situation. I am going to be visiting my daughter and spending about a month with them. What I noticed when I visited in the past is when their dog comes home from the dog walker at the end of the workday, usually I've noticed that within a couple hours, if nobody's taking the dog out, he will urinate underneath, always the same place, underneath the dining room table. I'm not just sure exactly what's going on here. The dog never indicates that he needs to go out, and my daughter will just clean up the mess, not say a word to the dog, and this happens pretty repeatedly.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to be staying with them for a month. Is there anything I can do to help with this situation? How do you retrain an adult dog?
I would be handling this dog just like I would a puppy. Short of the fact that I would make sure that this dog does not have any medical reason that would not allow them to be holding urine for 2 hours. That seems like a very short period of time. Most dogs don't have to eliminate that frequently. And so does the dog have something like kidney disease or diabetes or Cushing's disease or something that's making them drink more water and have to urinate more? So getting a clean bill of health is number one. Number two would be when they come home from from the pet sitter, dog walker, the dog should be confined and not allowed to be just roaming in the house. I would either have the dog, if they're comfortable, in a crate, or if someone is at home, put a leash on the dog and hook the dog to your belt. That way the dog is with you, and if they start indicating that they need to eliminate, you're right there to be able to get them outside so that you can give them that positive reinforcement of, good dog, you went to the bathroom outside immediately. That's very, very important. For whatever reason, this area has become the toilet area for the dog. And I'm not sure what your daughter's using to clean it up, but using one of the good enzymatic cleaners like Urine Off, Anti-Icky Poo, something like that to be able to clean it up. And perhaps even if that is the dog's preferred area, eliminate that from the dog's area that they can go in, putting up baby gates, something to prevent the dog from being able to go there. So it just comes down to, just like you would a puppy, the puppy doesn't get any freedom. If you can't be watching them, the puppy's confined. Same with the adult dog. And I love the umbilical cord method of training using a leash, because that means the owner or some responsible person is right there to be able to get the dog outside immediately and can be there to reinforce the appropriate behavior by eliminating outside. This will be something that if the dog doesn't have any medical condition, should be able to get under control very quickly with the positive reinforcement and you being another set of an adult eyes on the dog to be able to keep them from having an accident.
And maybe the walker is giving the dog a lot of water. When they walk.
It very, very well could be. Or, you know, is the dog walking but just not eliminating? I don't know. We'll find that out. Yeah.
Well, and just thinking about water, a listener couldn't stay with us. She wanted to remind people to take care with walking dogs, especially smaller dogs in warm weather. What are the dog owners' things they need to consider when it comes to exercise in hotter temperatures?
Well, yeah, sometimes even simple things that we forget about are the heat of pavement with sun and things, so pavement and concrete. If you put your hand on it and it's hot and uncomfortable, don't let your dog walk on it. And that's where maybe booties and things may be able to be helpful and help prevent injuries. But those would be times of the day where perhaps we just need to keep our dog inside and find something else to keep them entertained and only walk them in times of the day where it's not quite as hot. Having water with you, very important, especially, you know, on longer walks. And know your dog's capabilities. I have English bulldogs, and the three of them, even though they're all the same breed, all have various temperature susceptibilities. And one of them can exercise a lot. Weather doesn't bother him. I have another one that, boy, it just gets into the mid-70s, and he's ready to lay in the house in the shade in the air conditioning. So and you have to know your dog as well. And remember, obese dogs are not going to be as heat tolerant as a dog that's in good physical body condition. So watch your dogs that's overweight too.
Adam in Deerfield, your turn now. Hi, Adam. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question about our cats, which are indoor-outdoor cats. They've got what we believe are ear mites. They've got discharge coming from the ears, and there's kind of, you know, pull their ear back. It's kind of got this dark residue that's in there as well. They've been scratching at their ears a lot. I'm hoping that we can avoid going to their vet, but wanted to see what your recommendations were on treatment.
Yeah, most of the products that are going to be the easy ones to use are going to be prescription products. And if your cat is, you know, current with your veterinarian, they've been in to see them, you know, that might be an easy enough thing if your veterinarian feels comfortable prescribing something. I mentioned there's the heartworm, flea, and tick product called Revolution Plus that's put on as a spot-on. Unfortunately, only available via prescription. There are some other over-the-counter ear drops that you can get that are fairly effective, although you do have to use them like every other day for about 21 days. And so it can be a problem medicating cats. That's why these other products that go on once and you're done are nice ones to consider using for cats. So it may be worthwhile going to your vet rather than using, you know, one of the over-the-counter products that just is not that, you know, effective, but harder to use. And some of them say use it weekly on the bottle, but in reality, you really have to use them every other day. Those are usually pyrethrin or carbamate-based products. So if you're reading the label and that's what's in it, be looking at using them every other day. For your cats.
There you go, Adam. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Call in at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Erin in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Erin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a six-year-old Labrador retriever who developed an impingement syndrome as a puppy. And at that time, we were told, you know, we could get it further diagnosed. Maybe they could do, I thought it was at the coracocerebral arch, something very, very proximal. And maybe they could do a little release, but we could also wait. It might resolve. It did seem to resolve by two, as the vet had predicted. But now she's six, and it seems to have recurred, and it's getting to the point where even a basic play session will then see her limp. And we've added some joint supplements. We've done some other things. I'm just wondering if, are we missing something? Should we be getting another an opinion? I did have it checked again, and this was diagnosed now as a bicipital impingement.
Okay.
So maybe the same thing. So help.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think definitely getting a diagnosis is helpful. And that, you know, sometimes with soft tissue injuries, tendon injuries that aren't going to show up on x-rays, sometimes when we do see some tendonitis, you know, we'll see some changes on x-rays. Sometimes we'll see changes on other imaging studies like CT scans of joints, which are often a better modality for some joints to be able to get things like that done. And if your veterinarian doesn't have access to something like a CT scan, then going to somebody that is maybe a referral orthopedic surgeon to get a better idea of what may be going on so that we can come up with the right exercises, physical therapy that can be very directed towards the tendonitis that your dog may be having. You know, when it comes to other things that you can do, it sounds like you've got your dog on joint supplements. I assume you probably are also using some type of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory for pain control. But you're looking into acupuncture, but you're going to have a diagnosis to be able to know where to do the acupuncture. So it comes all the way around to you need to get a diagnosis and getting your dog to a specialist, I think, because they're still young, 6 years old. They've still got half a life ahead of them. And if they are that sore just after a regular play session, life isn't going to be fun much longer. So let's see if we can get this diagnosed once and for all and on the, you know, with the right therapeutic modalities, which is probably for tendonitis going to be more physical therapy than it will be surgical.
There you go. Good luck, Erin. Thank you for calling. Sandy in Big Bend, on to you now.
Hello.
Hi, Sandy.
I have a problem. I have a 13-year-old Shih Tzu, 13 and a half, actually, and she wasn't spayed, and she has been in like two or three different times to see the vet. She's licking herself all the time, her female parts, or her rectum. I'm pretty sure it's her female parts, and anyhow, I've been putting a pad on her during the day, so she stops licking just about continually, and there's just a tiny little amount, and there's no color to it on a pad. And I don't know if I should take her back or if at that age she could just be leaking.
Yeah. So things that I would be looking at is Is she leaking urine? If she is, that can be enough to cause some skin irritation or to draw her attention to the area to make her want to lick back there. Does she have skin fold irritation? Sometimes we will see perivulvar dermatitis or perirectal dermatitis as well that can be very itchy for the dog. So ruling out secondary infections like bacterial or yeast infections that need to be treated to be able to get them under control. It's unlikely that it's something like food allergies, although I have a friend who just turned 60 and developed a shrimp allergy. So age, you can develop food allergies at any point in your life. Has your dog suddenly developed some type of a dietary hypersensitivity? Often, besides being itchy, and it's usually perirectal itching, you can see sometimes it's around the ears and things as well. Often the stool may be a little looser than normal, but that might be something else to be looking into as well. But I would be looking at taking her into your veterinarian, make sure that they do some cytology of the skin in that area to rule out yeast or bacterial infections. And then, you know, really thorough diet history so that maybe we can get to the bottom of this. And then perhaps even consider medications to help control the itch, like Apoquil, which would be something that might make her feel a little more comfortable. It's a drug that we commonly use for dogs that have allergies. And I'm not saying that she has allergies, but that may be helpful to control the itch if they can't identify an underlying source like infection.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Sandy. Kathy in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn now. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning. Say we have a kitty who's about 11 now, 10, 11, and he's recently been diagnosed with hyperthyroidism. We've got started filling him twice a day and then had his blood levels, and then now he's on one because it was a little bit higher. But we have him scheduled to get the irradiation, the irradiated iodine, in July. And my question is, because we have to travel to the cities to do that, my question is the aftercare. I know we have to leave him there for a week, but for 2 weeks after, we have to have limited contact. And this is one of those dog-like cats that is just, you know, going to just always there next to you and loving. And I'm really concerned he's going to go into withdrawal because he's just got to be, you know, in your face all the time. We've got this, you know, the expense is going to be up there. And we want to, it's nice to take care of it. He's an easy kitty to pill. I mean, you just grab him, pop it in and go. But I know it's got a good success rate. But have you had any problems with some cats going into withdrawal because they just need that loving all the time and they're going to get it?
Yeah, well, what you're describing, you know, you've got a cat that sounds like it's well regulated on the methimazole, which is the drug that we use to control the overactive thyroid gland. Being young, your cat is a great candidate for radioactive iodine. We keep them in, there's a few places around the state that do it. You do have to have special licensing and things because you're dealing with radioactive material. And I know at the veterinary school, they're in a far off corner of the vet school with cameras on them all the time and only set number of technicians that go in for radiation level checks and so on are able to work with these cats. Once their radioactivity level drops so that they are considered environmentally safe, we send them home. But the instructions, you're right, are that we don't want them sitting on your lap or cuddling up around your neck because they are still emitting radiation from the radioactive iodine. And so it potentially could cause some side effects for you. And so this would mean either keeping your cat in another room in your house. You can still spend time with your cat, but you just don't want them sitting on your lap or cuddling up next to you while you're sleeping. And so that's going to be the problem is how are you going to manage your cat when they get home? Some people opt to keep them in a boarding kennel because they are considered safe, but they just need to be, you know, as long as the boarding kennel realizes that they have to handle the waste and things very carefully, that would be another option so that the cat doesn't have a lap to sit on. But again, that might be very stressful for the cat as well. I think they'd rather stay at home and get to see you part-time, but not all the time.
And if she was at a boarding kennel, how long would that have to last?
That's just usually about 2 weeks after therapy. We want to make sure.
A month at least.
A month, yeah. Yep.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. not the easiest thing to consider, but I think your cat will survive the limited attention that they're going to get for a couple of weeks once they're back at your house.
There you go, Kathy. Thank you very much for calling. Greg in Duluth, Minnesota, it's your turn.
Hey, happy Tuesday.
To you as well.
So I got a question for you. I've got a 2-year-old King Charles, brought it into the vet last Monday because he wasn't moving around too good. And while we were there, we were like, oh, we need to do the flea and tick medicine. They gave us Vectra. And we noticed about a day later, so Tuesday, Wednesday, he started biting at the air, almost like there was, you know, some imaginary birds up there. And he would do this, you know, incessantly for like 20 minutes a time, give it a break. And then he's been doing it since then. So we're kind of at a loss as to what's going on.
I really doubt that it's the Vectra. I think that it probably is a function of being a King Charles Spaniel. They have a lot of neurologic problems, mainly something called syringomyelia, where they can develop these focal seizures, neck pain, you know, madly scratching at their neck because it may hurt so bad. I would be going back to your veterinarian and saying, I think we might be having an issue with this. Taking photos of your dog too, or videos of them, so your vet can actually see your dog doing these types of behaviors. But I would guess that it's probably some type of a focal seizure disorder, and that may need to be treated. Usually, we treat these dogs with gabapentin if it's a pain related thing, and sometimes that does have some anti seizure properties as well. So, unfortunately, I think that's probably what it is, and not the Vectra. It's just coincidental.
All right. So that had nothing to do with it.
Most likely not.
Most likely not. Well, Greg, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She's a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her come by. And she's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Taking a look at your pet's health on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We've talked quite a bit about traveling with your dog and with your cat and some of the issues surrounding that. And all of our lines are filled, and we've got quite a few email questions as well, Sandy. We did have a question, and I don't know if we're going to be able to answer this one, about an emailer, Brenda, who said her dog stepped into Lake Michigan and wound up with fish worms. It was a long process to get rid of them.
Huh.
And, you know, wondering what the heck are fish worms.
I
so there
know.
Are a lot of different kinds of...
There are a lot of different... parasites that can be in water, like Giardia, and different infectious organisms like leptospirosis. And I know that in other countries, there's a guinea worm is something. And so I don't know if this is a dog that's been imported from another country, but it's possible that there's things like that that could potentially have been brought here. I'm at a loss, but I think any time there's something odd like this, it's always a good idea to save the parasite if it's been removed, have it put in formalin, and send it in for evaluation. Because if this is a new or emerging disease, we need to know about it so that we can start tracking it. Boy, this is not something that I have ever heard of in this country. But, I mean, there are... like water and fish parasites. Like probably the most well-known one is what's called salmon poisoning in dogs. Salmon actually have a parasite that affects them, but it's not the salmon parasite. It's another organism that affects the parasite in the salmon that's toxic for dogs.
Oh my goodness.
And can cause this thing called salmon poisoning in dogs, which is why you never want to feed your dog raw salmon. But you know, there's so lots and lots of things out there, but I have no idea. I wish I did. I know this email came up, and I've been madly trying to research it with Dr. Google, and I'm not able to find anything. So if this person has the worm and needs to have it evaluated, I would be glad to walk it to our parasitology department. And they are often very pleased to be able to see oddball things like that and try to get an answer for an owner.
So there you go.
Yeah.
You
send it to me.
Sandy Soschak at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine.
You got it.
There you go. All right. Well, let's go to Paula in Colfax next. Hi, Paula.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I'm calling today. I have a dog that's almost 15, and I just discovered a mass or a cyst underneath his tongue. I did some online research, and I'm feeling pretty confident it's blocked.
Salivary gland, maybe?
Yes, yeah. Thank you. And I think they're called a ranula. And so I'm wondering, do those ever resolve on their own? And if it has to be taken care of surgically, with his age, is there something I should specifically ask to maybe not have him put in such a deep anesthesia?
Yeah. Is he having trouble swallowing, or is he living with it fine?
He's living with it just fine. It was just random that I caught it.
Yeah. You know, because if it's small, it may be something that you just want to watch. There are other tumors that can be affecting the tongue and the oral cavity. So really paying close attention to it to make sure that it's not growing or bleeding or interfering with their ability to swallow or eat. Sometimes these will spontaneously go away on their own if they had maybe just a duct blockage. It's happened to me. I actually had a salivary gland duct blockage that it was one of the most painful things I ever went through, but that doesn't seem to bother dogs to the same degree as it does people. But it was, I can tell you from my own experience, was painful, but it did go away on its own. So with this, it's possible that it may drain on its own, but sometimes we do have to go in and help. And remember, age isn't a disease, and a 15-year-old dog that has good heart function, good kidney function, is well hydrated, can undergo very safe anesthetic procedures as long as, you know, they're being monitored appropriately. Obviously, there are some drugs that may take a little bit longer to recover. And so we want this dog to get back into your home as fast as possible. So, you know, coming up with a cocktail or a solution that would work well for your dog is going to be based on your dog's blood work and physical exam prior to having a procedure done. So don't be afraid to contact your veterinarian. There may be things that can be done just under sedation, such as maybe just physically draining the mass and confirming that it is saliva and it isn't something like a tumor that we need to be more aggressive with.
There you go, Paula. Thank you. From Paula, we go to Paul in Delafield this time. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have two supposed to be miniature schnauzers, and over the last 6 months to a year, the younger one first and then the older one began developing a tremor in their hind end. They seem otherwise to be healthy. They're not from the same family. They're 6 months apart from two different families. They happen to be schnauzers that are bigger than miniature schnauzers, although they came from families where both the male and the female were small ones. So I guess our only concern seems they sleep more than usual and that kind of thing as they've gotten older, but they don't show any signs of pain, although we wonder if, you know, if this is a painful thing for them and whether there's anything we should be concerned about just in terms of keeping them comfortable.
Yeah.
But the first just started out as it seemed like an intention tremor if they were anxious about something, and now it's become more common. And
We'll see this very commonly in dogs as they get older. Just that little bit of exertion, being asked to stand for a little bit longer. They may get some tremors in their legs. Tremoring could be from pain, from fear and anxiety, from just physical exhaustion if they've been asked to stand too long and they've got some muscle weakness. And sometimes we just see it when dogs get older. And these dogs are 14. If on their physical exam, your veterinarian is unable to localize any focal areas of pain, palpating down their back, going through the range of motion with their joints, looking for any other neurologic issues that could be compounding this, so I do recommend having a physical exam done. I mean, there are some other oddball reasons, but I would expect it to be full body tremors and usually some loss of consciousness, like generalized seizures, low blood sugar, hypocalcemia, which is like low calcium levels. You know, all these things can cause tremors, but, you know, to have them both being affected, both just their back legs, my guess it's just probably an age-related condition. And having them evaluated for something to see if they're painful, by all means, have that done, because there are lots of safe drugs that we can use for pain medications in dogs. Everything from gabapentin to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories to even some that are more directed at some of the pain centers. So be something that I'd be thinking would be indicated for them.
There you go, Paul. Thank you so much. Hollis in Verona, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a cat that's about 12 years old I rescued, and my vet recently retired. I have to take him to a new vet now, but over the years, he's always, like, scratched at his ears, and sometimes he flicks his head and liquid comes off, but the vet was never able to really, he had surgery for flaps, like the grown flaps of bacteria built in. He had that surgically removed, and he got checked several times for his ears, and nothing seemed to come up. So I feel bad for him. I feel like he's just kind of having a rough time with his ears over these years.
I mean, what I'd be concerned about is there an underlying, like, ears are usually pretty good at having the skin barrier that they do of not being infected, but is there some underlying reason, like ear mites, a bacterial infection, a yeast infection, something that is chronic and sitting there that needs to be actually addressed? So getting some of this material from the ear, looking under the microscope to see what organisms are there, potentially even doing a culture if necessary, especially if your cat's been on and off antibiotics over the years, to make sure that we don't have a resistant bug. A good otoscopic exam where you go in with the scope to have a look in there, potentially after cleaning the ears, so that we can see, do we have an intact eardrum? Do we have a middle ear infection that's continuing to bother the cat? So I think that would be kind of the basic start to be able to know what's going on. And I don't know if your previous vet did all those steps to be able to get answers for your cats, but I think that if you do go to a new vet, that would be a great place to start. Say, let's see, have a look in the ear. Would you please get cytology, culture if necessary, and then treat with the appropriate medications for the right length of time, and then doing follow-up afterwards to make sure that if there was an infection there, the infection's under control.
There you go. Thank you so much, Alice, for calling. Appreciate it. Margaret in Platteville, on to you now. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I love the show, and I'm grateful I haven't had a reason ever to call in, but I have a reason now. Another old pet question. My dog is a mixed breed, about 50 pounds, kind of a shepherd and collie and retriever mix. Beautiful golden dog with some white. Happy, happy dog, always playful, friendly, everything. He just, like 2 weeks ago, started shunning his regular kibble. And it's the stuff that he's been eating for a long time. It's a lamb and rice formula, I think a really good dog food. I can get him to eat cooked chicken happily, vigorously. He is pooping and peeing just fine, drinking water just fine, acting normal and playful as usual, but he is refusing to eat this dog food. Sometimes if I mix it with the cooked chicken and hold it in my hand, he will actually eat it in combination. But if I just put the chicken in the dish with the kibble, he can magically just find the chicken and ignore the kibble.
Oh, many dogs are like that. They're able to just winnow out all the good food and leave everything else behind. But I'd be concerned about oral pain in your dog being 14 years old. Does your dog have a bad tooth, a fractured tooth, something that kibble hitting it is making them not want to chew or eat their kibble? And especially with your dog being healthy and happy, I mean, there are some other systemic diseases that can make dogs feel nauseated and they don't want to eat their regular food, but will be very happy to eat really tasty, palatable things. But the fact that your dog isn't showing any other signs of being ill, I'd be worried about oral pain. If your dog's 14 and has not had a dental evaluation, and remember, awake dental evaluations only can tell us so much. We're usually looking at, under general anesthesia, doing a good oral evaluation, getting the tartar off the teeth, treating each tooth as an individual, getting x-rays of the teeth that are questionable so that we can see if there's any damage to the root structure. You'd be surprised what we often find when an animal is asleep for a procedure like this, but that would be the route that I would be looking into.
There you go. Good luck, Margaret. Thank you so much for calling. Her question about, or her comment about feeding cooked chicken reminded me we were going to be talking about a recent study on homemade cat food. What should cat owners know?
Yeah, this was a study that was done in the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association, and they looked at 114 recipes that were both published online and in books, and many of these recipes were actually written by veterinarians. And what they found is that this was just astonishing to me. 40% did not provide any feeding instructions. So you're making this recipe. How much do you feed? How often do you feed? Nobody, they didn't include that in almost half of the instructions. Zero of the 114 recipes provided all the essential nutrients that were recommended for adult cats. And although, you know, those that were authored by vets had fewer deficiencies, they still had deficiencies. And these are ones written by veterinarians. Some were even up to 19 essential nutrients were missing from some of the diets. The other things that were really, I thought, were just appalling, 7% of the recipes called for ingredients that were potentially toxic for cats, like garlic powder, onions, and leeks. So, you know, even though these are published recipes and they may have a DVM after the recipe formulator, really, really question whether these are safe or not. And if you want to use a homemade recipe, it comes down to work with a board certified veterinary nutritionist. And there are several out there that will do formulating recipes for you. And there's even companies now that will formulate diets for you and send homemade diets to your home. They're like the meal delivery service. And again, you've got to be really careful. Some of them are manned by people that are not in the veterinary nutrition business. But there are several good ones that are out there that can send you well-balanced homemade foods for your dog if you want to go down, or cat, I should say, if you want to go down that path. But just be careful.
Yeah. What is a balanced cat food diet include?
Wow, that is like all those little micronutrients and the right levels of calcium and phosphorus and the balancing the proteins and the fats. And it's not just protein, but the right levels of amino acids, especially for cats as well. We know that they are specific, you know, they really need taurine because they can't manufacture that themselves. So they have to have it provided at the right levels in their food. It's all those little nutrients, all that when you start looking down the makeup of the food, those are all important things to make up the food. And trying to do that yourself, you really need to almost be a chemist when you're trying to formulate a balanced diet for a cat.
And on the other hand, when you purchase cat foods.
Yeah. You want to make sure that it has received the AFCO, American Association of Feed Control Officials, seal of approval. Preferably foods that have gone through feeding trials so we know that they are complete and balanced and that they've been fed to cats. So we know that they're not only tested during manufacturing, after manufacturing, but then actually fed to cats to make sure that they are able to absorb and utilize the nutrients that are in the food, and that they are for the life stage that your cat is going through right now. You've got the right food.
And if you're missing one of those micronutrients?
Yeah, the problem is you may not see changes right away. But if you've got a cat and many cats become food fixated, you may have a cat on the same diet for a long period of time, and then you may start running into issues with, secondary heart disease, if you've got issues with not enough taurine in the food. If you've got too much of a vitamin E, you could start running into issues with, fat changes. There's all kinds of things like this, the oddball things that show up. So that's why I'm just a big believer in letting somebody else balance the diet for you.
Yeah, makes sense. Gloria in Waukesha, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Gloria.
Hello.
What?
My question is, I have a Yorkie blend, and when my 40-year-old son comes over, he insists on cleaning his ears. And I mean, like, he will lick his ears for 5 minutes.
Oh, his son's ear. Your son's ears.
My son's ear. Oh. The dog licks the kid's ear.
Oh. I wonder who is enjoying it more, your son or the dog. I don't know why. I mean, whether it's just an appeasement gesture and it's become habit now that, maybe your son allowed the dog to lick his ear once and now it's just become a habit. I don't know if I would encourage that. Dog saliva isn't, the most bacteria-free, thing that can be going in your son's ear. But I think there might be other things that your son can do to bond with your dog rather than doing that. He may find it humorous, but I don't think so. I'd stop that behavior if you can. And I don't know why. Yeah.
Well, you think about where else a dog licks before he licks your ear.
But, also, does your son practice good hygiene around his ears? Does he have like a chronic earwax problem or something that could be drawing the dog to that? My guess is it's just learned behavior and it's the son enjoys it and the dog does too. So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's go to Denise next in Superior. Hi, Denise.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Hi, I have an American Staffordshire Terrier. He's not quite 2 years old. Just this winter, kind of mainly March and April, he developed almost simultaneously a urine issue, which has cleared up. He had some crystals in his urine and also bladder infection. I took him in. He had a couple of accidents, which is unusual. They put him on an antibiotic, a vet, and then a prescription CD food, which cleared up the issue. We had his urine rechecked later, and it did clear up. I kept him on the CD food, however. I decided, I'm just going to go that route rather than, worry about this happening again. But at the same time, he also developed, allergies.
Mm-hmm.
He was scratching. He had sores and bumps on his skin.
So lots of problems there. Yeah.
Well, I like to get down to basics. There's three main causes for dogs to itch. Number one is parasites, so making sure your dog is on year-round flea and tick control. Number two is skin infections, bacterial infections and yeast infections. And we need to make sure those are diagnosed and treated appropriately. And then number three is allergies, whether that be environmental allergies or food-related allergies. And it's not the food, it's an ingredient in the food. So it comes down to just step by step ruling out all those things that can make your dog itch. And it sounds like if you've got sores and things that are there, they need to be addressed. And it probably means that your dog has some type of secondary infection.
And there you go. And with that, we are out of time. Sandy, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Sandy Sawchuk, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, will be back on June 25th, and we'll do this all over again with her, although we'll take up some other topics as we go along with her. So always great to have her with us. And taking a look at tomorrow, a National Senior Health and Fitness Day. So we'll talk about boosting longevity. That's at 11:45. We'll talk about energy efficient home design. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, hey, please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.